something good to remember.
That's what I was told, but I've heard it all sorts of ways. So you passed your audition. When can you start?
Oh, how about half an hour?
Well, this shouldn't be strange to you. After all, you did start out as a reporter right in Miami.
Yes, I did. I lasted for almost 2 years, and then I was fired.
That's better than most of us.
Oh, what happens to most of you?
Well, it's a tough field.
It is tough, and you have to live on your nerves, and that makes me very nervous.
Well, how'd you like to be a reporter in the Persian Gulf area? Well, wouldn't that be exciting?
I'd rather just watch. I think they've done an awfully good job, but, I mean, that's more in the line of soldiery, what they've been doing.
You know what? Boy, I wish I could have gone there.
Would
like
you
getting
have,
back into real journalism.
Well, that's... But, I mean, what about art? It's real, too. Books are real. They just last longer. I mean, the news changes, but the stories in books go round and round. I mean, there are wars in Homer, and there are wars in the Persian Gulf. But Homer's just been around a long time.
Wonder how many books of fiction will come out of the Persian Gulf War. Such a short war. It's
there should be name. Some. There should be some. I hope one will be about a woman. Maybe a woman in a woman pilot or a woman in combat.
Lots of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were prisoners of war. They were
killed. Oh, yes, and that too.
Yeah. But the war was so short. And I noticed that it wasn't until several years after Vietnam that Vietnam fiction began to develop, and good
mm-hmm.
fiction, too. But it took a long time. Maybe that was because some of the soldiers were so young.
That, and also, I think, because that we remember that as a sad war, and in a way, a war that reminded us that we could fail. And... paradoxically, good fiction comes out of sadness.
Well, explain that.
Well, maybe because you want to dwell on the reasons more. I mean, why was Hamlet so depressed? Why did he have to go haunt his father till his father came back and haunted him? If Hamlet had been a well-adjusted young man, he would have gone off and done something else, and then Shakespeare wouldn't have been interested in him and in making him up. It's there are depths in sadness and in tragedy that appeal to us.
I think, however, H.L. Mencken would disagree with you. I remember running.
Oh, he would disagree with everything.
That's true. But
what did he?
Well, there was a running debate that Mencken had with other people, people who asserted that an artist must live in passion, in suffering, in starvation, privation, should live in a garret, should freeze.
Mm-mm.
And Mencken said no. He said there's nothing to indicate that the poverty of the body is going to make an artist any better. He believed that an artist should be well fed and satisfied
mm-hmm.
so that he could go about the daily business of his art, whereas one who suffers has a much more difficult time in practicing his art.
That's true, I think. If you're suffering, you are living your art. You're making art out of your life. I find I work best when I'm living a very humdrum routine life and there's not much going on, and I do have regular meals and go to bed early. And then I can think about all these things, including sadness, more.
You can write with a degree of objectivity.
Yes.
You couldn't otherwise.
And also your imagination is free to plunge into the depths, and it really couldn't if your stomach was growling and you had lost sleep and you were living in a box out on the street.
I was talking to Toni Morrison a while ago, who, in some respects, some of her books... have been angry books, but she says when she writes she is completely dispassionate because
mm-hmm.
her anger would disrupt what she's trying to accomplish.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. You have to go down to a place where the waters are still and see what you can dredge up, but if they're all choppy, then you don't see anything.
Of course, I believe one of your early books Well, a lot of your books are about, you're right about sadness. One of your early books dealt with, I think, the breakup of your first marriage, and that must have been a sad occasion.
Oh no, not so sad for me. But in the case of my character, by the time I got finished with the book, it was a story of the marriage of two fictional people. I think she's more in a bind. She's trapped at the end. She isn't out of it. She and her husband have found an interesting kind of pain to inflict on each other in the perfectionists. And one has the feeling at the end of the book that they will go on enjoying this little pleasure of mutual torture.
I read that book years ago. That was partially set in Morocco?
In Mallorca, in Spain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the other part was set in London.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your latest book, Father Melancholy's Daughter, another book that is sad and poignant and at times very funny, too.
Thank you.
You do have a knack of being able to blend all of these things. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you one thing that I appreciated in this novel, and that was the characters and how they related to each other in such a polite, almost English fashion, mm-hmm. almost Japanese fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Because I grew up in a middle-class family. My father was rather blunt
mm-hmm.
when he dealt with us. And there was very little encouragement, per se. But in almost every instance, the characters would encourage each other and praise each other. The meal would be a wonderful, charming mm-hmm. meal, and the sermon was excellent. And I appreciated that.
I'm glad it gentled you down a little bit. Well, one reason is these people are Southerners. The second reason is this book, Father Melancholy's Daughter, takes place within a church community. Father Melancholy, that's his parishioner's name for him. His real name is Father Walter Gower. He is an Episcopal priest. He himself is a very gentle, courtly man, and he has brought his daughter up to be gentle and courtly. And then many of the other people in the book would speak like that. But then, of course, in all my books, especially with Southerners in them, there's the undertone. So you will have the polite words on the page, but then often there's something going on underneath that isn't so nice. For instance, an outsider shows up at a funeral, a kind of brash woman, and she says to one of the parishioner women there, she said, have you found Jesus yet? And the polite woman says, I didn't know he was lost. So that sort of thing goes on a lot too. You get a very gentle, polite, humorous often rejoinder, and then 3 days later you realize you've been wounded.
Also, I think the character is more blunt when they talk about other people.
Oh,
we
yes.
all do.
Oh, yes, yes.
And there are certain nicknames for various characters who are a little more aggressive in their approach to, say, the church life and this
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Yes, the father calls his bête noir, the man who's always baiting him and causing him trouble. The man's name is Ned Block. And the father calls him Stumbling Block behind his back. Then there's a very bossy woman called Elaine Major, and everyone calls her the Major to her face often.
Well, to kind of capsulize the narrative a little bit, Father Melancholy's Daughter is about a young woman and her relationship with her father after her mother goes away with an old friend in what may or may not be a lesbian relationship. And as a result, the father and the daughter become extremely close. And the thing that I wondered about is how the father used his daughter as a confidant, confided in her in ways that most fathers and daughters would never confide. Can you comment on that?
It was the peculiar relationship between them, I think. He trained her early. He realized she was smart. He taught her to read when she was four. And she would, when he would have a depression, even when she was 6 years old, she would want to know about it. He called his depression his black curtain. And she would say, well, now, Daddy, why is it that you go behind the black curtain? You know you don't enjoy it. And he would laugh and say, of course I don't enjoy it. And I don't go behind it. It's just that one morning I wake up and find myself behind it. And then she, very early on as a child, has this fantasy that she's going to go behind the black curtain sometime and save him. And this becomes a fantasy of hers that eventually turns into a reality. She does become his savior and his keeper, and in a way his parent for the next 16 years. When she goes away to college, he says, now go ahead and try to enjoy your youth. You've been a good little parent. Now try and go enjoy your own childhood.
But she never really did
no.
she?
No, she's just not made that way. She's not a very fashionable heroine. I have met a few young people who are like her. Maybe it's the new wave or something. You know, you go so far down and you lie around sniffing expensive drugs for just so long, and then you think, well, maybe I'll go back and be old-fashioned and see what I can do in the way of duty. And she, more and more as she gets into her 20s, finds that it's more of an adventure to live by what she calls the grace of daily obligation than it is to live with instant gratification as your religion. So in that sense, she's a bit unfashionable, but I liked her a lot, and I do know some young people like that. I know a young man at college who, for instance, gave up a very snazzy car his family had bought him and traded it in on a big four-door car so he could drive all these old ladies to church every Sunday. Now, that doesn't sound like anything recent, but it's right now that happened.
Had the daughter's, what was her name? I forgot.
Margaret.
Margaret's father, mm-hmm. had he not suffered the stroke and died? I don't really want to give, it comes fairly close to the ending, and I want to give it all away on mm-hmm. the air, but had he not had the stroke, would she have been prepared to devote the rest of her life to him had he survived?
Well, as the author, I would say perhaps yes. She simply wouldn't have had the she would think of it as heartlessness to break with him, because once during the book, you know, she's fantasizing about marrying this young priest that she falls in love with, her father's friend, and she thinks, well, there's really no reason why we couldn't take my father on the honeymoon with us. I mean, we're not an ordinary family, and they'd enjoy each other. And so she might have stayed with him. I have considered that.
She have an awful lot about the Episcopalian church and its rights. You were not an Episcopalian when you grew up, were you?
Yes, I was. I was. I was confirmed when I was 12 years old in a church very similar to Father Gower's. It was an Anglican church, a high Episcopal church, with all the colorful liturgies and the Stations of the Cross and confession, and it stuck. And also it makes very interesting material. The villainess in this novel, a stage designer who becomes a performance artist named Madeline Farley, she's the woman the mother runs away with, she gets just a sniff of the church when she goes to see her friend, and she starts using it in her theater pieces, and it makes her famous. Of course, the church people aren't very happy with the way she uses it. But I find it all very generative, the church seasons and the saints and the colors and the passion of Christ. It lends itself very well to parallels and patterns.
Had you retained all this, or did you have to go back to church at some point to relearn it?
Oh, I went back. I went back to church after having stayed away for something like 30 years. And I have kept in touch with my first spiritual mentor, the priest who confirmed me. We've been writing back and forth for years. So he was a great help. And then I joined a church in Kingston, New York, and the rector there was extremely helpful. He gave me all of his English experiences as a curate in England, and let me just have them for my Father Gower.
Did he show you all the vestments as Father Gower showed Madeline?
No, but I kind of observed and imagined. Yes, Madeline in the book goes back, finds the father in the sacristy, and first she asks him if he'll model the vestments, and he doesn't feel he can do that. But then she says, well, could you just show me what goes on top of what? And he does. And then later in her theater piece, which becomes famous, she has a scene in which God is undressed on stage, and someone in the audience remarks, my goodness, she knows just what goes on top of what. And the father is just sick over it, that he in a way provided her with the material to blaspheme his own calling.
Boy, so much ritual. I remember years ago when I was a teenager, my mother decided to upgrade her religion and go to an Episcopal church rather than a Presbyterian. And so she dragged me to the point where I could no longer be dragged as I got older, but she dragged me to an Episcopalian church, and she'd been going there for some time. I was so embarrassed. We sat got into the pew, and then we had to kneel down.
You never know when to get up and sit down.
No,
and not
but I was
kneel
so
down.
Embarrassed. My mother kneeled down, you know, and made the sign of a cross, and I'm sitting here, you know, get up, mother, get up. We don't do that. We don't do that. So I was so embarrassed, you know. But
how long did you last?
I think I went once.
Uh-huh.
I got to the point where she couldn't take us, except on Christmas, I think. Mm-hmm. She would finally corral my father and my younger brother, and she would drag us to Christmas services, but we were not a very religious
Did
family.
She stay in then?
Yes, she stayed in until she died. She was very active in the church, and my father would drive her to church and drop her off, and then he would drive over to my brother's house for a couple of beers, and then come back and pick her up and take her home. He was not active in the church at all, but she was what you call a church lady.
A church lady.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So like some of those in
there
the
are
book,
a lot in the book. Yes.
Right, a lot in the book, and she would cook, and she would volunteer, and she would do exactly the way the ladies did in Father Melancholy's Daughter.
But a lot of these ladies gossip all the time and give poor Father Gower a hard time.
Well, I'm sure the ladies in my mother's church never did that.
No, I'm sure they didn't.
I'm a little confused about the differences. You say that the church that you went to as a child was an Anglican church. What is the difference between the Episcopalian, Anglican, and indeed Catholic?
Well, the Anglicans, they are Episcopalian, but they actually call themselves Anglo-Catholic. All right. They go along with the way the Roman Catholics do a lot of things. The ritual, the devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. They just stop at the Pope. And also, Episcopalians and I believe even the Anglicans now are very, very open to women priests. There's still a little bit of fight going on in England.
But the rituals are
the
are
rituals
similar.
Are similar, yes.
Well, I was doing some research on a story I was trying to write, and I needed to get some prayers and some hymns. I wanted the prayers and the words of some prayers and hymns. Mm-hmm. So I went over to St. Michael's Episcopal Church on Amsterdam Avenue near my apartment, and I noticed, it was a stroke of luck, I noticed that St. Michael's was sharing the church with a Congregationalist church.
Mm-hmm.
And I went and I talked to the priest, and he gave me the hymnals. And they were different. And the prayers were different.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly different, but almost the same. But it would take a scholar to be able to determine the difference between the Congregationalist, which is, I think, an old line, rather severe church, and the Episcopalian church.
But some of the prayers were very different.
Different?
Yes, I think.
And creeds very similar.
The creeds would have been different, probably.
I don't know. But
did you get your story done?
I'm still working on it.
Oh!
I've been working on it for years and years, I'm afraid. This is an absolutely beautiful book, Gail. You say it's a matter of about 3 years to put all these words together, huh?
It's taking longer and longer. Let's see, I finished A Southern Family in 1987 and started thinking about Father Melancholy's Daughter, and I only finished it last March 89. Well, that's not so bad, 2 years. But then it takes a year to get published. No, wait a minute, I finished it in 90, pardon me. So it did take 3 years. This is 91.
Yeah,
we're in,
as far as I know.
Yeah.
Things, all the days run together.
It takes about 3 years.
But I would imagine, you've been doing this for a long time, I would mm-hmm. imagine that you develop skills and shortcuts and things that... I've noticed that there seems to be a progression or a pattern among writers. They often start out with little skinny books with short stories, and,
uh-huh.
And they wind up with great big, huge generational novels sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think writers hone their skills. No?
I'm trying to think. My books certainly are getting longer, but I seem to have to work harder over sentences. Now, I don't know why that is. Either I'm getting old or I'm getting more careful.
Or maybe the sentences are more complex.
Maybe the sentences, that's the kind interpretation. I hope that's true. It takes me much longer, say, in the course of a day's writing to get that obligatory page. I do feel I should write a page a day. Sometimes I write more. But if I don't write a page, I feel I haven't gone to my job and put out what I should have.
Feel guilt.
I just feel slothful. You know, the great sin of sloth.
Well, join the club. Seems to be a way of life for me. Sloth and guilt.
You don't look slothful to me.
Well, creatively, I sometimes feel that way. Believe it or not, although I've been a journalist for 32 years, I studied creative writing in college. Hollis Summers was...
Uh-huh.
I don't know if you remember Hollis. He was a Southern writer from, mm-hmm. from Kentucky.
Now, people are always asking me this question. I would like to put an interviewer on the spot. And it's not really fair, but you're so intelligent. People are always saying to me...
I don't think Hollis Summers would agree.
Why are Southern writers different? And I just go absolutely tongue-tied. Of course, I've memorized a few things to say now. But why would you... Have you ever thought about this? What should I say?
Why are Southern writers...
They say, why are Southern writers different? Now, some of them say, why are there so many good Southern writers? You can't answer that or you walk right into the trap. But do you find Southern writers in a category by themselves?
Now, I've been thinking about that, and I think I have an answer.
Okay, will you tell me?
I don't think Southern writers are different.
Oh.
In fact, Mary Hood wrote... a collection of short stories called Venus is Blue.
I love that book, by the way.
Well, her first published story was originally set in, I believe, Alabama. I think that's where mm-hmm. she's from. I could be off in one of the states. But she got it published in Yankee. All she mm-hmm. did was change the location to make it New England.
Is that the one about the father out of work?
I can't remember. It's been so long since I've read it.
Yeah, it could be. It could have been.
All she did was change the location.
Really?
But the people were the same. What happens is the writers aren't any different.
Mm-hmm.
The location is different. You never hear of anybody referred to as a Middle Western writer or a New York writer except under certain circumstances. But there is a geographic identity. The South stands out
mm-hmm.
in a variety of ways, through language, through culture, through food,
mm-hmm.
in ways that Wisconsin, Minnesota, Kansas... They don't stand out well. California doesn't stand out
mm-hmm.
too well. So there's a geographical distinction, and if you're from the South, you hold that distinction.
And you come carrying all this flattering baggage. Is that what it is?
You hold a geographical distinction,
uh-huh.
but the writing isn't necessarily different. In fact, mm-hmm. the finishing school was, although they dealt with some Southern characters, was
mm-hmm.
set in New York.
That's right.
So
I'm going to say that next time.
Well, that's only my theory. It's not.
Well, it'll at least get me through another interview.
But I think it's flattering to have this geographic distinction, because I don't feel I have any myself.
Where are you from?
Kansas.
Well, you just have a thing about being from Kansas. You ought to start saying, well, we're different because we tell the most interesting stories. And we have dust storms like nobody else and certain kinds of... thoughts come out of being in dust storms.
I have to make that up. Well, that's mm-hmm. I was talking to Jim Lehrer of PBS.
And yes.
He's been writing a series of novels about a young man with one eye, one-eyed Mac, who comes from Kansas.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
And it turns out that Jim was born at Wesley Memorial Hospital in Wichita, Kansas, the same hospital I was born in, mm-hmm. 2 years before me.
Mm-hmm.
So we were discussing this remarkable coincidence because there are so few of us from Wichita. And we thought, well, we'll hold a reunion of all Wichita, Kansas writers and hold it at the Holiday Inn. We'll round them all up and hold it at the Holiday Inn.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't think of anybody else.
Oh.
In a very empty Holiday Inn. They just have to get a little room. Let's get a single.
That's right.
Well, let's see, what else can we... What else should we cover before we... Well, oh, just talk to me a little bit about your everyday life up in Woodstock and how it operates.
Well, usually it's very peaceful, and I get up in the morning and go upstairs to my study, look out the window. There's a nice view. I have a few friends. I see them sometimes.
There are people who live locally in Woodstock?
I swim in a pool every day.
Even in the winter?
Well, that's the one luxury I've allowed myself through all this. I've decided to build an indoor swimming pool because I have been a swimmer all my life. And before I did this, I would have to break in my riding every day at 11:45 and then get in the car and dash to the next town where there's the nearest Y. And rush in, and then I could only swim for 30 minutes because it closed at 1 o'clock. So I've always wanted to do this, and I'm glad I've done it.
So you have your own pool?
Yes, and I swim in it every day.
Well, I bet you're very popular.
Hmm?
I bet you're very popular.
No, in fact, I have to invite people because people are too shy to say I'd like to come and swim in your pool.
Where is Woodstock exactly? I was up visiting a friend, and... It seemed that Woodstock was filled with a whole bunch of different towns, and I drove miles and miles, and I still seemed to... There's a main town called Woodstock.
That's right. It's not very large. I mean, you might have just driven through it without noticing it. It's just a village green and a few little stores.
But my friend, who is an anchor person here,
mm-hmm.
Has a lovely house. He built it himself, but it's 15 miles from Woodstock.
Oh, where? In Phoenicia or Lake Hill or something like that?
I don't even know if it had
like
a name. It was so far out in the woods. But
Woodstock is near Kingston. It's a little bit near the Hudson River.
Kingston's a nice town.
Yes, it is. Kingston has a lot of beautiful old houses. Kingston was the first capital of New York way, way back when.
Do you get to Asheville very often?
Yes, I have a second home in Asheville, and I go there as often as I can.
What's it like going back?
It's like stepping back into some of my books, because a lot of my imagination seems to be anchored in those old landscapes. So that's why I like to return often.
I have a theory that as one becomes older, sometimes the sharp images of our youth become even more clear.
I think you're right.
You know, I can't remember anything I did last year, but I can mm-hmm. remember things that happened to me when I was six.
That's happening to me. My teen years are just starting to come back. They were a blank for years. Now they're just starting to come back. In fact, my next book I'm going to write about a kind of Heathcliff and Kathy couple who were in high school. And I all of it's coming back. Of course, it helped that I found a lot of old letters that I had written to a friend, or rather, she sent them to me. I wrote very detailed letters when I was 14 to my best friend when I moved away from town. And she sent them to me, and there's all this wonderful lost material, and everything in there triggers everything else. So I'm having a bonanza.
A diary?
I've kept a journal since I was in my early 20s, but I didn't keep a journal as a teenager when all that all that turbulence was going on. So now I have some of it back, and I'm very grateful for it.
Do you ever look at your journal and because you're going back to your 20s, you look at your journal and all of a sudden things that you'd forgotten about become clear again?
That happened, yes, when I was stuck between books, and out of a journal came a novella called Mr. Bedford. I had gone back and was looking at a journal written when I lived in London in the early 60s, and I was writing about this interesting older American couple that I lived with, and all of this was in there, and the way the other boarders who lived in the house talked, the English expressions that I would have forgotten, the things that were going on at the time. So I was able to get a whole novella out of it. It was just sitting there waiting to be formed.
Because a journal doesn't have to be a detailed analysis of all the people you meet, just sometimes a list of things you did, and that will...
Yes, and all too often I find when with my youthful journals, I could just kill that girl. I just moan and groan and say, I feel bad, or so-and-so doesn't love me. And I want to say, well, what else, you know, what else was happening? Was there nothing else? Did you see nothing that day? Did you hear nothing? Did you have no conversation? But I'm getting better about that.
Well, post-adolescence is an exercise in being maudlin. I tell you, I found a cache of poems that I'd written in college and right after college, where I was very lonely and very sad and mm-hmm. very caught up with myself, and they're so embarrassing that I would write that crap.
Well, don't hate yourself, though, because, you know, the young man who wrote those has something that you still need. That's the way I feel about that young woman. She had the quality of yearning, and we mustn't lose that.
But I like the idea of lists. Did you read the Tree of Night by Hugh Nissenson?
No, what kind of lists are in there?
Well, it was a diary of a man who lived in Frontier, Ohio, I believe 1820s.
I believe I know about this book.
It's a wonderful book, very thin book, but uh-huh. it's essentially a diary, but it's also a matter of lists. He just made a list, and through the list, you could tell everything that happened in his life, because he would list so-and-so died today.
Uh-huh.
Went to market, picked up butter. Every time he masturbated, he would indicate it in the list.
Did he have a little star?
Yeah,
a little star or something.
So you got mm-hmm. to know when he did that, when he met somebody, when the Indians came.
Mm-hmm.
Four people killed today by Indians. Just matter-of-factly.
Mm-hmm.
And when you finish the book, there was a whole life there, a life in a list.
That sounds like something I'd want to read.
Oh, you would love it.
Is it around?
Oh, yeah. It was nominated for a National Book Award.
Oh.
Hugh Nissenson, Tree mm-hmm. of Life.
Tree of Life.
It's in paperback now, and it should be available. It's a beautiful book.
I'll go find it.
Well, Gail, I guess I'm glad you came in early, because now I can go get some lunch and...
We don't want to starve, do we?
No, we don't. This is absolutely a beautiful book, and I love your work, and I hope that we'll continue to maintain contact, and if I continue this show in the future, that you'll be back. And we'll
Maybe
talk
in
again.
3 years we'll talk again,
if
not before. You better be here.
Well, you know, you don't know about the broadcasting industry or the status of CBS.
No. Or the publishing industry.
Or the publishing industry.
Well, we can always meet at a pub or something.
But, I don't know, with a writer, you have a great deal of consistency. I mean, I don't think you're going to go away in the near future.
Well, that's very heartening to hear that. I don't plan to.
I hope you don't. It was great talking to you.
Same here.
Much.